welcome to another edition of T Watches a Scary Movie. I am T, and we're talking scary movies. I appreciate everybody tuning in. Remember, you can watch this episode premiering on our YouTube channel. The link is right here. These are where the new episodes are going to premiere, and then we're going to upload them to the Facebook group a few days later. But again, premieres are only on YouTube. So I appreciate all of you tuning in. Make sure to subscribe. I need those subscribers. And make sure to join our Facebook group as well for T Watches a Scary Movie. That link is going to be right here as well. So, we recently got done talking about Thanksgiving horror movies. We did indeed watch Thanksgiving, which was awesome. So much fun. I'm excited to watch Thanksgiving 3 at some point down the line. And we are getting close to talking about our holiday horror movies. I told y'all this was coming up. The month of December, we're going to take a bunch of holiday horror movies, and there are a lot. And we're going to watch a few, and that's really going to be the focus of the show over the coming weeks. Now, we're not going to do a million of them like we did with Halloween. And it's funny because Bloody Disgusting, a site I love, just recently put out a list of, like, I think it was like 210 holiday horror movies, and we are not watching that many. Don't have the time for it. Also, don't want to watch that many. But we have some good ones coming up, so you're going to be excited for that. We also have some cool toys and stuff to show off to y'all as well. But before we do that, this show, we are talking about comic book horror movies. So there is some new movie coming out called The New Mutants that I really wanted to see. I've been wanting to see it for a while. And based on everything I had known about the movie, I knew it was going to be a horror movie and that it would kind of fit for the show. And because of that, I took that as an opportunity to revisit a couple other really, really good comic book horror movies that are out there too and kind of put them all together. So that's why we're doing this episode tonight. So let's get into it and talk some comic book horror movies. Our first one that we're going to be talking is Blade 2. Now, back in 1999, New Line effectively kickstarted the Marvel movie phenomenon by releasing Blade, the original Blade movie. And it wasn't really marketed as a comic book film. They really did it as this cool action horror flick. You know, Wesley Snipes is super awesome. He's got a sword. He's wearing glasses. He got these cool guns and everything. It was going to be cool. But they didn't really make it a comic book movie. Like, they weren't trying to put it out there like that. And what's interesting is that in all three of the films that we're talking in this episode, all of them had a connection to the start of the big comic book movie movement, you know? And Blade is just so interesting because the fact that, you know, it's a black superhero starring in the, you know, as the lead role there, and that's kind of big for then. But just the fact that that was the film that led to the Marvel brand on movies and started being a thing, and we get the Fox Marvel movies, and then we get, you know, to actual Marvel Studios and everything, then Disney gets involved. And so it's crazy to think this all kind of started with Blade. That's ridiculous to think. It's a great movie. It's a fantastic movie. It's set 2 years after the original film, and Blade and his new weapons tech specialist, Scud, have tracked down Whistler, who they thought was dead, but has actually been turned into a vampire. And they give Whistler the cure, they turn him back to human, and there's no time for them really kind of chill out, figure out what's been going on, and kind of catch up. Because a local vampire tribe recruits Blade to hunt this new breed of vampires called Reapers that have risen up. And yeah, we're going to talk more of the horror aspects of these movies than really the whole comic book parts. Just because if we do that, it's a completely different show at that point. And we can get in about how it did this in the comics, but it did this in the movies. So keep in mind, we're not really going to focus that much on the comic book roots, okay? And with that being said, the original film built such a strong world, like such a great world for Blade. You know, we were led to believe that there's all these vampire families that are out there. All of them have, like, you know, bits of power in the world. Everybody knows about Blade, and you can't turn people, and you can't do certain things without approval. Like, it's just this vast, huge world. And so the idea that one of these families is going to, like, put everything to the side, all these issues they have with Blade, who hunts them for a living, to stop this other foe is very, it's just so intriguing. It's incredibly, incredibly cool. And what's even more interesting about that is that we know it's not going to go well for anybody. Like, if the idea is that Blade's working with these vampires, the movie's just a boiling point until eventually one turns on the other. And we know it's coming, so when it eventually gets there, man, it's so, so good. It's no secret that I don't have a fondness for Guillermo del Toro. I think he's pretentious, he's overrated, and I think he takes on a million projects knowing damn well he can't finish the majority of them. But man, did he do a good job with this movie? The first film I mentioned was like an action horror hybrid, but it stayed closer to horror because it left the few action set pieces like far in between. Like, the film really played out like a horror movie, and then it's like, okay, Blade has this big battle at the beginning, has this big one in the middle of the movie, has this big one at the end of the movie. But in between all that, it's just a horror movie. And the sequel rides that line even more, to where sometimes it's very much an action film, but sometimes it's more so the horror movie. The Reapers and vampires work the same way, which means if they wound you, you're on your way to becoming one. And because of that team aspect, the movie actually kind of plays a little bit like The Thing, because every time the team encounters the Reapers, we're just waiting to see, did somebody get infected? And then when are they going to turn on the team? When are they going to reveal themselves? And that actually added a lot of fun to the movie, because we just don't know. In some cases we do, but we just don't know when it's going to happen and who is going to get hit next. The Reapers themselves are awesome. They're awesome. So unlike the traditional vampire fangs, their jaws split open to give them a larger bite, and then they reveal they have like these barbed tongues. And I will say, as cool as they are, Del Toro loses a lot of points as he basically recycled this design for the Reapers for the TV adaptation of his series The Strain. The vampires in that, exactly the same as the Reapers, like almost verbatim the exact same. And I guess they're his design, so he can do what he wants, but it's laziness, man. That is laziness. Ron Perlman, Donnie Yen, Tony Curran, Matt Schultz, and more make up the blood pack that works with Blade. And everyone has their own character niche. Ron Perlman, who Del Toro uses a lot, is given the most to work with, because he's the guy that's, you know, everyone's like, yo, take out Blade. Like, we don't work with Blade and everything. And he's the guy that will actually do it. And so he's the hard ass of the team, and he plays that so well, because it seems you're always seeing Ron Perlman play an asshole, and that's what he's really good at, is playing an asshole. And hey, guess what? He's playing another really, really good asshole in this movie. And you can interchange this character out with the same one in like Alien Resurrection. This could be Hellboy. Like, it just, that's just what Ron Perlman does. A lot of people have trouble deciding whether or not this film or the original Blade is better. And it makes sense, because both movies are really, really good, and they give Blade strong character acts to work with. In the first film, it's about him possibly being cured of vampirism and being able to live a normal life. And like, he gets this revenge and he can be done. And in this one, it's about trust. You know, can he trust Whistler? You know, who just got turned back from being a vampire. Can he trust the blood pack? Because they, you know, they want to kill him too. Can he believe Nomak, who's telling him something about a big conspiracy with all of this? So there's a big, big arc here for Blade in regards to trust, which makes sense in a vampire movie, because, you know, you never know when's going to turn on you. And that was really good, because seeing Blade have no one to turn to, meant that he had to let his guard down at some point. In the first film, you know, whether it was Whistler or I think it was Karen, he had somebody pretty much the entire time to where he could bounce whatever off of, he could talk to, give his quips to, and stuff like that. And in this one, he can't really trust anybody. Nobody can really be there for him like it. And it's interesting because the moment he does let it down, that's when he gets screwed, basically. No jump scares in this one. No jump scares or anything like that. But I will tell you, Del Toro can craft some great horror when he's splitting Blade and the Blood Pack up in it. There were so many scenes where they split the group up and everyone has their own individual face-off with the Reapers. And some of them are actually pretty, pretty terrifying because some of them win their battles. Some of them definitely lose. And when they lose pretty damn bad. And, you know, we're thinking for a second, okay, like, well, these are vampires. And, you know, the only people we've seen that actually can hurt vampires is Blade. That's what the first movie kind of showed us. So they're kind of invincible, right? But not really, because these are super vampires now that are hunting you. So it was interesting and actually kind of scary to see some of the situations they put Blade and the Blood Pack in over the course of the movie. You can't go wrong with Blade 1 or Blade 2. I don't know which one I would ultimately say is better. It really depends on the day. Frankly, if Blade 1 didn't have that one line, the some motherfucker's always trying to ice skate uphill. If they didn't have that line in it, I would probably say Blade 2 most of the time, but it really just depends on the day. They're both really, really good. Make sure to check it out, especially if you want a little bit more Blade in your life. Next, we are talking From Hell. Now, again, let me state we are not using comic book accuracy as a point of contention. It's important because From Hell is an adaptation of an Alan Moore graphic novel, also done by Eddie Campbell. And Alan Moore adaptations are usually very controversial, mainly because he hates them all. He doesn't like any of them. He doesn't want his work adapted. So a lot of people who are big Alan Moore fans instantly just, they won't check out the movies, or they'll just say right off the jump, these are terrible. So just putting that out there. In 1888, Mary Kelly and a small group of London prostitutes trudge through unrelenting daily misery. When their friend Anne is kidnapped, they are drawn to a conspiracy with links to high society. The kidnapping is followed by the gruesome murder of another woman, Martha. And it becomes apparent they are being hunted down one by one as prostitutes are murdered and mutilated post-mortem. Now, that description would be putting it lightly. This movie is a retelling of the Jack the Ripper story, just with a little bit more meat on the bones than what we're really accustomed to, honestly. It's not a nice story, and that needs to be said. And what I mean by that is that, you know, this is not a movie with joy really in it. There's not a lot of wins for our protagonists in this one. The majority of the film is set in the crime district of London. People are robbed, stabbed, shot, maimed, murdered. We don't really get to see London in that much of a positive light in this film. Johnny Depp portrays our main protagonist, Inspector Aberline, the troubled policeman assigned to the case. He's well known around the city just because his previous work has been guided by what he calls psychic visions. And he's no fraud, regardless of the fact that his visions may be coming from a drug-induced stupor. He might be touched, but we don't know. His visions are actually, like, real because they do show us exactly what he sees. And whether or not he actually has these powers or they're coming from the drugs, like, he's seeing real visions that he'd have no possible way of knowing, you know, beforehand, honestly. So I like that element of this story is that, you know, he's not a fraud. He's absolutely not a fraud, but we're not focusing on how he gets these visions. There's really no interest in that at all. We are led to believe, though, this has been something that he's been going through for a while, and that it's not, you know, this is not like the first case that he's had to use this for. So, you know, he's tortured. He's clearly like an alcoholic because of maybe what he feels through the cases that he solved. But this is obviously not the first time he's had to do it. And all the better for it, because the killer's a unique one, at least in the tropes of, like, a horror movie. He's charming, he's rich, he's manipulative, more than that. And it's really to hide all the brutality that's there. You know, when we find out who the killer ultimately ends up being, it's so interesting to see that that character and the traits and the way that they behave in the movie really covers that up well, to where you almost can't believe it is who it is that's behind all of it, you know? Now, the Heather Graham, who was our female lead of this role, this was kind of like in the midst of like her big, not break, but her dominance in Hollywood, because she had like a 7-year run to where she was the one that was in like all the big blockbuster movies, and this was kind of at the tail end of that. And this was actually kind of a different movie for her, because usually the roles she was playing, like, yeah, they were good roles and all, but there just wasn't a lot with them, I guess, if that makes any kind of sense. And she's actually incredibly entertaining in this role, especially because she has the right eyes for a horror film. Like, she gets very, very wide when something scary is going on. And yeah, she does an incredible job playing Mary Kelly in this film. The movie ultimately, though, it does end on a bit of a dour note. Once Johnny Depp's character discovers what's going on and everybody that's involved in it, nobody actually gets brought to justice. And he ultimately ends up killing himself. And it sucked, but it was fitting, because his character didn't solve it for, like, the lack of trying. Like, he saw what was going on. He just couldn't do anything to actually stop anything that was happening, because even with these visions, he's still just a regular person. He's one person, and he's back in the 1800s. What, you know, there's not that much he could actually do. So it kind of actually made sense that he would end up killing himself, just because, you know, you can't really live knowing a lot of what he knew at the end of all of this. And in terms of scare, so much gore in this film, but actually good gore. And you know me, I'm not the kind of guy who likes seeing a lot of very visceral gore, but this was actually really tastefully done. I mean, Jack the Ripper was known for his violent killings, you know, like, so they couldn't really shy away from that. And the film doesn't shy away from that at all. Flesh, blood, broken bones, cuts. And it could seem like overkill, but it's all, again, very fitting with the tone that the movie's taking, especially, you know, it being a comic book adaptation. It's, you know, the more read, the better in a lot of cases. This film's actually a bit of a prototype, weirdly enough, for the first Sherlock Holmes movie, the one with Robert Downey Jr. A lot of the plot points hit the same. A lot of the character traits are the same in that as well. And obviously, I mean, you know, there's probably nothing relating to films at all. But if you watch From Hell and then watch Sherlock Holmes, it just seems like two very similar movies. But it's a really good one. A one that a lot of people haven't seen and haven't heard of, honestly. And especially because it's not one of those big, quirky Johnny Depp ones. Like, Aberline is actually as close to a normal character as Johnny Depp would ever play. So that might be a big reason why a lot of people didn't hear about it or see it. But who knows? But check it out if you can. Our last movie is The New Mutants. Now, if this went under your radar, I don't blame you. This film has been on the shelf for 2 years, pretty famously. There were a lot of rumors about script rewrites, about reshoots being done, studio interference. So this film has been infamous more than actually being famous itself. And at one point, they were considering making like a trilogy of these New Mutants films. But because of how long this took to actually come out, the sale of Fox to Disney and their subsequent ending of the Fox X-Men universe, this actually has the honor of being the very last Fox X-Men film. And that's crazy to think about, because I remember seeing the original X-Men at a drive-in theater back in Lompoc, California in 1999? It was 99 or 2000. I don't remember exactly. It was one or the other, though. And to think in 2020, this is the end of all of that. It's all done. And what a movie to go out on. I mean, the X-Men films of the last decade have been vastly different from the ones of the decade before that. And they're all really action flicks, you know? Like, they had some good drama in a lot of them, but they were all really just action movies just trudging along. And the idea of doing one as a horror film was always going to be, like, super, super interesting, you know? I mean, you can't just switch from action to horror like that. You always do it in reverse. That's what Aliens taught us, you know? But they did, you know? They chose a fairly simple plot to adapt to a horror setting, and it actually worked out extremely well. Danny Moonstar is an orphan, and her entire family gets wiped out in a tragic accident. And she ends up at this facility. And at this facility, it's designed to really help these young mutants learn how to use their powers before potentially becoming X-Men. But sinister forces have set their sights on these kids. Now, X-Men film openings can usually go one of two ways. You get the kind of meh opening of Days of Future Past, where it just shows, like, the concentration camp and then the young mutant being killed. And, you know, that's it. And that sounds cool, but it really wasn't cool. Don't kid yourself. That was not a cool opening at all. Or it could be like X2, where it's like Nightcrawler going and trying to murder the President of the United States, which was so kick-ass and so awesome. I remember seeing that at midnight. And even though I don't really like that movie that much anymore, damn, that was so good and so cool to see. But the New Mutants opening goes a little in between. We get to see the craziness that unfolds for Danny and her tribe as it's wiped out. It's sad, but it's such a crazy and frantic set piece. And because we know it's something not human causing it, I mean, it is an X-Men movie, you know, we have to expect that. They do a good job of building the tension right from the beginning of what actually caused everything to Danny and her family. Then the movie at that point just shifts to the facility, and that's where we are for the rest of the movie. And it's a dark and dreary place, and it's almost like a parallel of Xavier's school, because, you know, you think of all the X-Men movies where they're at that school, and most of the time it's a happy, upbeat place, you know, cheerful things are happening, and, you know, it's a very good place. And this facility is the exact opposite of that. It's lonely. You know, the kids are feeling despair, they're depressed, like, it's the exact opposite of Xavier's school. And all of these kids there with Danny have had tragedy unfold in their lives, too. Like, Danny's not the only one to have gone through a tragedy here. Anya Taylor-Joy plays Ileana, who is actually Colossus's sister. For those who don't know, that is supposed to be Colossus's sister. That's the guy who, you know, puts the metal all over his body. You know, her character escaped child slavery and abuse. Or Sam, played by Charlie Heaton, who was accidentally brought down a mine on his father and his co-workers. All the kids come from some kind of dark past. And that kind of helps set, like, the feeling of the movie itself. Like, it helps actually build to the dread in the facility because, you know, there's not really anything good coming from these kids' past either, honestly. And Danny is actually our eyes in the movie, and the fact that she's never at ease in the facility keeps us feeling that way the entire movie as well. And it gets interesting because the movie takes cues from Nightmare on Elm Street. They're routinely haunted by ghosts and demons from their past in their dreams. But just like in Elm Street, like any kind of damage they get in those dreams, like they suffer those scars in real life. And even Dr. Reyes, you know, she's that character who, she's the kid's only contact, the only one they can really talk to about what's going on, but she doesn't really believe them, but she's also hiding something too, and that's very Elm Street-like for the adults, you know, in those movies. And there are some good scares in this too. The smiling men that show up are incredibly creepy. I would love, or would have loved to see them pop up like in a subsequent film, honestly. And even beyond that, The demon bear that shows up as well, too. That's a pretty terrifying design, too. I enjoyed the different thrills that I got from this movie that I wouldn't get from a typical X-Men movie, you know? Like, it's not like the adrenaline rush that you get from watching those films. It's the scares that are doing it for you in this film. And make no mistake, they have the typical X-Men team up and battle and use their powers and stuff happening, too. But the scares are in this movie. And we have to talk about the accents for a second. As I mentioned, Anya Taylor-Joy, who's American, but she's actually Argentine-British, was using a Russian accent. Charlie Heaton, who is English, was using an American Southern accent. Macy Williams, who English, was doing a Scottish accent. Let's just say those accents can be distracting. They were, yeah. But beyond that, there is actually some good parallels to The Breakfast Club as well, beyond like the Elm Street stuff. It's pretty obvious if you watch the movie. And same with Buffy the Vampire Slayer, though they go a bit far to kind of telegraph it by having the kids watch an episode or have an episode of it on in the background. It's actually one we watched on a recent watch party. It's the Hush episode. But this is a really good movie, and for being one of the only Marvel horror films that's out there, they have to be pretty good. And this actually was, in my opinion, a really good note to go out with for the X-Men films. But then again, I like Dark Phoenix, so what do I know, obviously? And that's going to do it for our films. Now, like I said, we are getting into Christmas horror. So you're going to see a lot of that coming over the coming weeks. I am still going to be working, though, on the list that y'all put up that you want me to go through and start watching. We got things like Maximum Overdrive coming up, and we got a bunch more. We're getting into a bunch of the ones that y'all have been suggesting for me to check out. So we are going to do that over the next month, along with our holiday films. I have some toy unboxings coming. I have some great Christmas sweaters to show off to y'all as well. And we're going to get back into some giveaways, too. So, as always, I appreciate you watching. Please make sure to like, to comment, to share. Make sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel. Make sure to jump in and join the Facebook group. And if you want to participate in a future Scary Hot Challenge, we eat something super, super hot. I'll pay. I'll send it to you if you're not local. And we talk scary stuff. If you want to participate, let me know. But that's it, y'all. I'm T. We've been talking scary movies. Stay scared, guys.